Estate versus Dante Allen, two, but we'll take appearances. Please go ahead.
Margaret McLean, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Dante Allen.
Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey, as a friend of the court.
Raymond M. Brown of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey, as amicus.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. Alicia Woodard here on behalf of the state.
Deputy Attorney General Frank Roski on behalf of the Attorney General, as friend of the court.
Please be seated, everyone, except Ms. McLean.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if it's necessary.
That's fine.
And during the argument, I'd like to focus on why the detective's testimony that the surveillance video showed Allen turning towards Officer McGee and firing the gun was inadmissible lay opinion testimony that requires reversal of Mr. Allen's convictions. I'll rely on my brief and any arguments from amici about the need for 104 hearings and jury instructions in future cases, though I'm happy to answer the court's questions on those issues as well. In this case, there were three different factual scenarios presented to the jury. First, that Allen turned to face Officer McGee and fired his gun directly at him, as McGee testified to at trial, which would lead the jury to convict Allen of attempted murder. Option two is that Allen did not turn to face McGee and did not mean to fire the gun, which would lead to an acquittal, and this is consistent with Allen's trial testimony. Or option three, that Allen fired the gun but didn't aim it at McGee, relying on Officer McGee's prior inconsistent testimony from the suppression hearing that Allen had in fact fired the gun over his shoulder while running. And while this wouldn't lead to a complete acquittal, it would preclude a guilty verdict for attempted murder and instead lead to a verdict on one of the lesser included assault convictions that require reckless, something, a mens rea less than purpose to kill. And Detective Campanella's opinion testimony about the video impermissibly put a thumb on the scale in favor of this first version of events at the expense of the other two. By opining that Allen turned towards Officer McGee and fired the gun, Campanella discredited both Allen's trial testimony, that he did not intentionally fire the gun, but also Officer McGee's statements from the suppression hearing that Allen didn't turn around. Turning towards someone implies targeting that person or an intent to aim at that person. And this amounts to implicit vouching of the state's theory of attempted murder, rather than either an acquittal or a conviction for one of the charged lesser included offenses. And as this court has repeatedly recognized, any improper influence on the jury that could have tipped the credibility scale is necessarily harmful and warrants reversal. And that's the result required here. This opinion testimony was inadmissible because it violated the rule underlying all of this court's cases on lay opinions. Admissible lay opinions are derived from the witness's firsthand perceptions. For example, the officer in Labruto's opinion on the point of impact was based on his extensive in-person observation of the car accident scene. The detective in Singh's opinion about the similarity of the sneakers was based on his in-person observation of those sneakers on the defendant the night of his arrest. And the parole officer in Sanchez's opinion was based on her more than 30 prior in-person meetings with the defendant. It is this in-person experience that helps ensure a lay witness does not, quote, offer lay opinion on a matter as to which the jury is as competent as the witness to form a conclusion.
So how do we harmonize the statement in Singh that Rule 701 does not require a lay witness to be superior to the jury in evaluating an item, nor does it require the lay witness to offer something that the jury does not possess, with the statement in McLean that it sounded like you were just relying on, that Rule 701 does not permit a witness to offer a lay opinion on a matter as to which the jury is as competent as he to form a conclusion?
It goes to the two different parts of 701. In Singh, when, as this court noted, where the detective had that personal firsthand knowledge of the sneakers in real life, he doesn't need anything in addition to that to render his opinion helpful. He doesn't have to be some sort of sneaker expert or have some special ability greater than the jury's to observe videos and observe sneakers. But Singh is consistent with Sanchez, with Labruto, and with Lazo, that you first need this in-person perception as a threshold matter. And this court's case law or this court's decision in Lazo demonstrates kind of the opposite scenario. In Lazo, the officer saw the composite sketch, saw the arrest photo of the defendant, and from those things formed the opinion that the composite sketch looked like the defendant. And this court said that that opinion was inadmissible because it wasn't based on prior knowledge. And that's not saying something like the officer didn't literally see the photograph, he didn't literally see the composite sketch. He had seen those things and he formed his opinion based on that, but that's not sufficient for an admissible lay opinion.
Could there be some things, though, that the officer did have some knowledge of that might be permissible? For example, the officer was not present, in my hypothetical, at the scene of the crime when it occurred, but had gone there later, or was generally familiar with that from the officer's beat, and you know where one object or tree might be related to the position of something else there, or the nature of the lighting in general. Could the officer narrate about things that the a shorter list of things the officer had some knowledge of, which did not entail being there when the crime occurred?
Absolutely. 7-0, as this court said in Sanchez, you don't have to be there when the crime takes place. The officer in Sanchez didn't have direct personal knowledge that it was the defendant in the car. She had this prior real-life experience with the defendant that allowed her to form an admissible, helpful opinion about the photograph. And to Your Honor's hypothetical, for example, identifying a camera angle, identifying where a camera is, timestamps on video, or the hypothetical in, I believe, the ACLU's brief about the hill on Main Street. Anyone, including a police witness, who has personal knowledge to support the opinion they're giving is competent to offer that opinion. They don't have to be an eyewitness to the crime.
And in this case, for example, Detective Campanella, was there a problem with his testimony about the crime scene and what he did with respect to that? If you were narrating the video with respect to just that?
Not at all. For example, he discusses, he compares both the engineer's diagram with the video with his personal experience at the crime scene, discussing, here's where I found shell casings, here's where I looked most carefully for evidence, etc. All of those opinions are proper. The problem...
Then why wouldn't plain error review apply here? Because while at trial there was a generic objection to Detective Campanella's narration before it began, I think you just conceded that Detective Campanella's narration in general was not problematic to the extent that he was talking about how he processed the crime scene and where he decided to look for shell casings, etc. But then there were no objections to any specific questions or answers, which is what it seems like you are pinpointing as the problem.
So, no, respectfully, the state had Detective Campanella on the stand, was about to play the video. Defense counsel said, objection, sidebar. And specifically, he said, I don't think it's really necessary for Detective Campanella. Oh, sorry, I'm reading the wrong thing. He said, I don't understand. There's nothing the officer could tell us about it, speaking of the video, because he didn't observe it. And that's it. Whereupon the prosecutor says, we're going to elicit questions about why he did what he did. And the judge said, I think it informs the route, and then that's it. But defense counsel did make the correct objection. He made the objection that Detective Campanella's opinions based solely on the video, based on what the video depicts, based on his review of the video, is inadmissible because he didn't observe it. That's the right objection, and having seen a lot of 701 cases, that's a pretty good objection compared to many kinds of 701 objections. And we don't require trial attorneys to keep making the same objection over and over again. So when Detective Campanella starts talking about what the video shows, that it shows Mr. Allen turning towards the officer and firing the gun, the only objection defense counsel can make is the one he already made and was overruled on, that Detective Campanella didn't observe that. He didn't observe Allen turning. He didn't observe Allen firing the gun. And that exact objection was overruled by the trial judge.
Can you say that the words, I guess, one more time? You said he can't tell us about it because he didn't observe it?
Yes. So he says, I don't understand why it has to be played again. It's just There's nothing the officer could tell us about it because he didn't observe it. And it's in the context of the prosecutor about to play the video while Detective Campanella is on the stand. And this is at the whole kind of objection colloquy is 60, pages 27, line 10 to 28, line 15. And in case this court would like further support for the fact that this what the defense attorney was under the impression that this had been a preserved objection, he does later on specifically mention these sorts of things again, that at the later when discussing stills from the video at 6T page 197 lines 10 to 17, defense attorney again points out that he didn't really think it was necessary for Detective Campanella to offer these opinions about what the video showed, but he didn't object again, which he said was very difficult to do. And then the motion for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, the defense attorney said that, essentially said he objected to Campanella testifying with respect to the surveillance video because he wasn't there, it was overruled. And that's at 11T, page 9. So I think this was objected to. It was objected to on exactly the correct basis, which is Detective Campanella's testimony that the video shows Allen turning towards Officer McGee and firing the gun is not based on his personal perception.
So even if it was plain error, clearly capable of producing an unjust result?
Yes, I don't think it's plain error, but yes, it is clearly capable of producing an unjust result because this is the contested material issue at this trial. Attempted murder is a very difficult thing to prove because it requires this purposeful action, and Detective Campanella's testimony implicitly vouches for the state's theory of attempted murder at the expense of both a full acquittal or a conviction on one of the charged lesser-included offenses.
The prosecutor contends that the things Campanella talked about were admitted by the defendant. I've looked at that transcript myself. I'm sure you have, too. Is that a correct characterization of what the defendant's testimony was? That he admitted he turned toward the officer and that he admitted firing the gun. Did he admit those things? Do you have citations that can assist us on that?
No, he did not admit it. At 8T pages, or page 54, lines 8 to 14, he testifies that he turned to the side and he could see McGee out of his peripheral vision. Turning to the side is fundamentally different from turning towards someone, because turning towards someone implies, particularly in the context of holding a gun, implies an intent to aim at that person, to target that specific person, whereas turning to the side is more neutral. And the prosecutor tries to cross-examine Allen about whether he, in fact, turned to face McGee or targeted him in particular, and Allen repeatedly denies it. 8T 54, line 25 to 55, line 8. Allen denies that he ever got, that there was ever a point at which he got the gun pointed at McGee. Later at page 80, lines 14 to page 80, line 21, he's asked, you turned your body 100 degrees and faced Officer McGee, correct? He responds, impossible, and it goes on like that. So he admits that he turned his body at most to the side. He does not admit that he turned to face Officer McGee, that he turned towards Officer McGee, let alone that he fired the gun at Officer McGee.
You use the words firsthand perceptions, in-person experience, or perception. What is the legal authority for that?
All of this court's prior case law on lay opinion testimony, including Labruto, Singh, Sanchez, and Lazo. It's also supported by interpreting the words of 701 itself. 701A says it's rationally based on the witness's perception. And as human beings, all of our opinions are based on our perception, unless somehow we form an opinion based on telepathy. So those words cannot possibly mean, I literally saw a thing and therefore I have an opinion, because if that were the interpretation, the officer in Lazo would have been giving an admissible opinion. He saw the picture, he saw the composite sketch, but that's not good enough.
Does the court need to go as far as making that declaration for you to prevail in this case? Do we need to address perception, firsthand perception, when it relates to videos that deal with particularly complicated matters, confusing matters, and the like, the subject of an earlier argument in front of this court?
No, this case is clear and can be taken care of by simply reaffirming what this court has said many, many previous times, that you don't get to call a police witness to testify that the defendant is guilty, and that's what this officer did here. I think, particularly in light of this court's grant in Watson, I think there will be additional opportunities, but this case could address those issues, but this case is really about an experienced detective offering an opinion in which he vouches for the state's theory of the case at the expense of all possible other options for the defendant.
Additional questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. McClain?
Again, I would ask this court to hold that Detective Campanella's testimony is inadmissible lay opinion, and it was unduly prejudicial and requires the reversal of Allen's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Everyone is, of course, welcome in here. If children are going to be making noise, we would ask you respectfully to please step outside. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court. I will leave the prophylactic rules to Mr. Brown, and I'd like to just address two questions that came before the court. Second, I'll get to yours, Mr. Chief Justice, about complexity and necessity to decide in this case. But I'd like to start with Justice Wayne Raptor's question about plain error. Because this is a theme in the Attorney General's brief, that this single objection is insufficient to get us into the harmless error analysis, and we should instead proceed under plain error. And I think that's wrong for three reasons that I'd like to highlight. The first is that's not our law. That's never been our law, that a single objection is insufficient. There are states where you need to object to every single question, but our rules of fairness and whether or not the other side is on notice about what the problem is. And here, the other side was certainly on notice about what the problem is. And I think Ms. McClain lays out the fact that it was actually a pretty clear objection. But the other problem is the reason we're concerned about lay witness narration, and in my brief, I cite to all the cases that have been decided by appellate courts recently, it's an emerging issue that's becoming a bigger and bigger problem, is we're afraid that police officers, who we know are treated as special witnesses by jurors, are unfairly putting their thumb on the scale. And if we were to impose on Mr. Allen the obligation to not just raise the initial objection, but every time the officer says something that is harmful to him, to say, wait, I don't want that in either, then what we're asking him to do is to highlight for the jury the very problem. Each time that Officer Campanella, Detective Campanella, says he turned or this is where he shot, you're asking him to stand up and alert the jury, this is the problematic thing that I don't want you to focus on. Our court rules have never required that, and with good reason, because from a trial strategy.
For a sidebar. I did. Not quite as dramatic. I'm just saying, standing up in front of the jury and proclaiming your position doesn't have to occur in such an overt way. There can be more subtle ways at sidebar to confer with the judge on the other side.
But respectfully, Judge Sabatino, you still have to get to sidebar. And so the jury will still have heard the problematic testimony, watch defense counsel stand up and ask to be heard, and if that has to happen 15 times during the course of the argument to preserve it, you're really focusing the jury's attention laser-like on that issue. And I think any trial attorney will tell you that that's one reason that objectionable material sometimes comes in. Mr. Brown can speak to it better than anyone in the courtroom, but it's a real fear is that the jury focuses more on it. We haven't imposed these sorts of rigid rules, and I want to live in that world where we don't, but it's worth noting in the what's sauce for the goose is also sauce for the gander that the state did not cross appeal here. There is a finding of error, and the only question before this court is whether it is harmless or not harmless, because that's what Mr. Allen petitioned on. And so I'm not suggesting that the Attorney General shouldn't be able to bring up, as an amicus in this case, this new idea of plain error. But if we're going to be rigid about rules in some instances, we certainly should do it in other instances.
So that's your third point?
That's my third point on point one, on question one, correct. On question two, which was the Chief Justice's question, I think you absolutely can decide this case very easily. I think the harm is really acute. And Judge Sabatino, I read the concessions that were alluded to by the state in the same way you did as non-concessions, which is to say it was very much in dispute. And I think Ms. McLean really beautifully laid out that there were three possible paths. And there are, the state says essentially, come on, Mr. Allen's, that wasn't me, Your Honor. The state's assent, I apologize.
Hang on just a sec, please. Go ahead.
The state's essential position is that Mr. Allen's theory of the case is preposterous and can't be believed because we have expert testimony that rebuts it. But the jury doesn't need to fully believe Mr. Allen's theory of the case to reject the state's attempted murder theory, which is turning, aiming, and firing purposefully. As Ms. McLean said, in my experience, attempted murder is the single hardest charge to prove in our criminal courts because the mens rea requirement is so significant. On the second question, as to complexity, further on that. So you don't need to. But to the extent you're interested in doing so, because there's the Higgs opinion is still pending, there's a Watson argument to come, briefs and argument to come, let me suggest that there's a distinction between the January 6th videos, which have been useful in prosecutions, and the sort of thing we see here. If you have a situation where there are lots of videos and you have to splice from one and zoom in the other and use facial recognition in the third, that starts to look a lot like that which is beyond the ken of an average juror, of an ordinary juror, where Rule 702 would be appropriate, where a police officer who has training in how to splice and dice and zoom could offer expert testimony, of course, then subject to the safeguards that Rule 702 imposes, including providing an expert report beforehand so that the defendant knows that to which the witness will testify to. This is not that complexity. No one suggests it's that complexity. Everyone agrees this should be analyzed under the lay opinion rule, and I think there is a straightforward result that the court can reach.
Last question for me. Officer McGee,
yes,
testified as a surviving lay witness about issues that are ultimate issues for the jury, right? In terms of the defendant turned toward me and he pointed at me and fired at me. Now, he took the stand as a lay witness. What permits him to comment or address those ultimate issues for the jury in his own testimony as distinct from Campanella?
Because they're based on his firsthand perceptions. He was at the scene. We of course couldn't have a rule that didn't allow witnesses to testify as to what they saw, heard, observed. That is the nature of evidence. But so it would be bad enough if it were a stranger to the incident, and that's effectively what Campanella is. But he's a stranger who comes dressed with this grandeur as a law enforcement officer and gets to talk about his training, and we know juries treat that differently. So McGee would be a totally different situation. Of course he can testify to that, but Campanella as a stranger plus is not permitted to.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown.
Good afternoon, Your Honors and adversaries. Your Honor, we have in our brief focused on the procedural issues, but we do not wish to be so cabined because we think the substance of these issues are vital, which is why ACDL is here as amicus in this matter. Your Honor, to address an issue that the Chief raised, we agree with Ms. McLean that you don't have to decide that perception issue to give her the results she requests, with which we agree here, but you will sooner or later have to address that perception issue because it lies at the heart of this. And to go to what Judge Sabatino was raising, it has long been accepted within the realm of lay opinion that you may say that Brown turned to the left. If you're observing Brown turn to the left, in a sense, that's a mixture of fact and opinion, but we've long accepted as within the realm of lay opinion. Our issue is, and I think this is why perception is relevant, you can't look at the same video everybody else is looking at and offer your opinion when you have the subtle and unvetted imprimatur of police expertise without being qualified, and when you're crossing that impermeable membrane between fact and opinion without a judge having made that conclusion that it is proper to do so. And that is the problem with where we stand here. I think that it's important to note, and why ACDL is here, is we are at the threshold of something new. The proliferation of surveillance, which the body politic and the political branches have said it's helpful with apprehension, probably helpful with prophylaxis, we hope, deterrence. But when it comes to that which is admissible, the opinion of a person who may be seen as an expert, when we're talking to sophisticated people, my children and my grandchild are very perceptive observers of video. They've watched more video in their short lives than I have. And young children who watch sporting events will confront you with the burden when there's replay in a sporting event. I've had young kids argue with me, well, you know, Mr. Brown, you're wrong about that because it has to be overwhelming evidence to overturn the call in the field. So we're dealing with a video literate universe of jurors. Then we should not be weighing them down with these impermissible opinions. And to Judge, go to the question about superiority, as Singh, I think, respectfully, Justice, that misframes the question. The question is, should we allow this bolstering by an agent of the prosecuting authority to offer opinions about things which jurors are fully capable of assessing on their own with the evidence, the assistance, obviously, of argument by counsel? And I think we ought not to do it. And we do need, if Judge Susswine thinks there's no clear law, I thought McLean gave us a clear line rule, but if Judge Susswine says it ain't there, then it ain't there. And I do think we need clear guidance, because well within the authority of this court is to regulate the jurisprudence that comes before it. And over and over and over again, you will be confronted with the question of harmless error when these things occur. Because, and this is where I'm reluctant to do this, but I think because I'm 76, I'm entitled. I would play with the word narration. Judge Susswine says play by play, because it seems to me it has always been true that a police officer or a lay witness will look at an individual photograph and say, that photograph is the same as the tree I saw 3 weeks ago or yesterday. So it's always been true that we do comparison between the known sneaker here and the sneaker in the video. But when you have narration, which is the talking over and giving a stream of consciousness or a stream of questions, and by the way, to dovetail on what Mr. Shalom did, he's a brilliant fellow, so he gave me one little thing I could say. I mean, to have the raised eyebrows.
That's more than most get.
That's well, he likes me, even if there isn't enough deference. But to have the raised eyebrow of the judge when you've made the 15th request for sidebar, when the jury has seen you over and over again seeming to hide from something, it seems to me puts an unfair burden, which is why one of the things ACDL has highlighted has been the notion of a 104 hearing, where the judge does a reasoned process as what is fact, what is opinion, where there is a perception issue, where you have a chance to challenge lay opinion if it's ever going to be admitted, although I beg. Usually I'm here arguing for nuance. Today I beg for a bright line rule. And I think it seems to me that we need that in advance. I would move away from the word narration, as I said before. And I think it's important that the point that Ms. McLean made at the beginning of her argument needs to be focused on. And here I serve no more than the fellow coming with the trumpet saying, this is important what she said. And that is when we look at culpable mental states. For example, the appellate division in this case said Toth was useful on the question of whether it's harmless error. Well, Toth was important, but the foot pounds to be applied to the trigger isn't the only issue when you have a cop with 26 years experience offering in effect the opinion that he turned towards the defendant, which goes directly to the most disputed issue in the case. Did he have the culpable mental state required by the statute? So it seems to me that this requires a refined analysis. I do think, and this has come up a couple of other times when I've been before the court, it's proper for this court to say, we don't want to invite endless harmless error dispute. It is not an easy kind of dispute. In this case, it is easy, because Toth, and even let me take McGee, which is the tough case. Here's a person who had the reasonable perception, perhaps, that he was in a life-death struggle. You can challenge his perception as a cross-examiner. And so the question isn't whether the defense has a perfect theory. It's have the issues raised a reasonable doubt about the state's theory of the culpable mental state. And because of variance principles, they can't change it but so much and didn't try here. It seems to me that the question is, was there a layering of bolstering and vouching that could very likely have turned the tables? And in this case, because you can distinguish McGee and Toth, the others relied upon by the appellate division, there was. So we do join in supporting the position of the PD on this case with respect to Dante Allen, but we also say there is much to be done as we have an increase. And Judge Justice, I don't want to suggest that there weren't videos when you and I started practicing. But I think both of us, between handheld cameras and body mics, which, by the way, were offered by people seeking to enhance police accountability. So there's a broad range of public interest in having more video. But in fact, if the video is somehow imperfect in enabling the state to meet its burden of proof, guess what happens? Not guilty. Because that's the system to which we subscribe. And we cannot try to make a video more perfect by the use of improper and permissible evidence to bolster or somehow change the perception that jurors themselves must be making under the second prong. So I thank you for this opportunity, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Woodard.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The state would like to just touch upon Detective Campanella's testimony. It wasn't impermissible. It actually fits squarely within this court's holdings in Singh and Sanchez. Detective Campanella's testimony was based on his own perceptions of the surveillance video and his personal observations of the crime scene. He wasn't required to witness the shooting firsthand, nor was he required to be present when the surveillance video was made in order to provide admissible lay opinion testimony. And his testimony was helpful to the jury because the purpose of his testimony was to explain to the jury how he used the video to inform him in his investigation. So the state would urge that this court find that his testimony was permissible under Rule 701.
But his testimony went beyond that. Isn't that correct? It wasn't just testimony with regard to how he processed the scene and how he conducted his investigation. He also talked about what he saw taking place in the video, specifically what Mr. Allen, what the defendant was doing with regard to whether he was turning and shooting. So it went beyond just discussing his part in processing the scene. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. But his testimony, his testimony was like, as in Singh, he was basically describing for the jury what was visible on the screen. In terms of his comments of whether, you know, defendant turned or it was, the gun was fired, he never expressed an opinion that the defendant did so purposely or accidentally. Just because he said fired doesn't necessarily mean that a person did so purposely rather than accidentally.
Well, but the question was whether the defendant fired the gun or whether it was discharged accidentally. What basis did he have to testify that the defendant fired the gun?
Well, Your Honor, it's based on the fact of his observations of the video. He was giving his opinion as to the actions that occurred in the video. It wasn't as to the mental state.
If that's so, could the state have called another dozen witnesses, set aside an objection based on cumulative testimony, and had one after another say, I watched the video, I'm telling you, members of the jury, the defendant fired at the officer.
No, Your Honor. Only because in this particular case, it wasn't just any person. It was the lead investigating detective. He saw the video, but he also was able to personally observe the crime scene. So
how did that enhance his determination as to whether the gun went off purposefully or accidentally, whether it was fired or discharged accidentally?
Your Honor, I believe him using that term fired or discharged, it could be ambiguous. Again, he didn't tell the jury this is what was done so intentionally or accidentally.
But he did testify that the defendant turned towards him, whereas the defendant testified that he did not turn towards him. So why was that permitted? He didn't, in his experience of processing the crime scene, he obviously didn't see if the defendant turned toward the police officer or not. That you're saying he got just from the video. Why was that permitted for him to say, this is where you can see the defendant turning around?
It was related. It was related, again, to how he processed the crime. When he said that the defendant turned towards the officer, his testimony in relation was, the defendant turned, so therefore I'm going to find evidence in this particular area of the field when I get there. Just like when he said, both Officer McGee and the defendant ran across this area. They didn't drop anything, so I'm not going to look here. So again, it was in the context, it was all in relation to where he would find relevant evidence.
Could that justification be overused to get the extra witness on the stand, to how he processed the investigation? That would be a very frequent kind of argument, I suppose, prosecutors would make, to get that second witness up there to then take the occasion to begin narrating the video, and then we get into some problems with them overstepping the reasons they've been called. It sounds like that would be routinely a reason you would say to the judge, I would like my detective to tell the jury how he processed the investigation. Isn't that, sort of inviting the kind of problem we're seeing in this case?
No, Your Honor. The state has the burden in this case. And so, again, they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So having Detective Campanella testify as to his investigation was to negate reasonable doubt. Again, we've all seen the O.J. Simpson trial, a sloppy investigation equals reasonable doubt. So, again, Detective Campanella was put on the stand to establish for the jury that based on his observations of what he saw in the video and his own personal observations of what he saw in the crime scene, that he conducted a thorough investigation.
But that doesn't justify opining on the ultimate question for the jury, does it?
No, Your Honor, but it's the state's belief that, again, he didn't. It was, again, it could be ambiguous how he said fired or discharged, but he never expressed the defendant's mental state in this situation. And even if this court was to find it an error, it would be harmless.
Why would it be harmless?
Well, the state still had Investigator Toff's testimony. Investigator Toff laid out for the jury that it was impossible for the gun to discharge or fire accidentally based on the fact that it needed some amount of pressure on the gun. It had a firing pin block, which wouldn't allow the defendant to just discharge the gun accidentally. And then,
do you agree that it was inappropriate for Detective Campanella to offer that testimony as a lay witness?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Detective Campanella, when asked, said, as Smith and Wesson, couldn't be accidental. Was that appropriate lay testimony?
Your Honor, during the cross-examination?
Yes.
It was based on the question that was asked by defense counsel. Defense counsel, again, during this direct examination, Detective Campanella didn't express an opinion. It was only when defense counsel asked him whether it could be done accidentally, accidentally or purposefully. Your Honor, again, if the purpose of Detective Campanella's testimony essentially was based on what his what he saw from the video and what he saw from the crime scene. But again, if this court were still to find that his testimony was inadmissible, it would be harmless. We still had the testimony of Officer McGee, who was an eyewitness, and testified as to what he experienced since he was the victim in this case, and then officers, Investigator Toff's testimony.
Other questions?
I just have one coming back to the transcript. On further reflection, do you agree that the transcripts do not support the notion that the defendant in his testimony admitted turning towards the officer and that he admitted firing the gun? Do you think the transcript on reflection supports him admitting those things?
Well, Your Honor, he stated that the gun was discharged, and he stated that he turned towards, page 54, he did say he turned to the side. While he did not say it was towards the officer, he did at least, again, provide that this is what happened. He had the gun in his hand. He turned his body to the side, and the gun did discharge.
Is that consistent with him being shot in the back of the leg by the officer? If he was turning towards the officer, as the state posits,
would it be consistent with, and maybe I'm misremembering the record, that he was shot in the back of the leg?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
He was shot in the back of the leg, right?
Yes.
Is that consistent with the state's theory that he admitted facing the officer?
No, Your Honor. However, again, when the action happened, he could have easily turned back around, and that's when it, I believe in the testimony, when the officer stated that defendant turned towards him and fired off the gun, somewhere in between that, that's when Officer McGee fired a shot. So he
turned back around.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Following up on one of the Chief Justice's questions earlier as to whether the state could put forth a dozen witnesses to watch the video and state what they see in the video, would the defense be able to also have a defense investigator who's watched the video and gone to the crime scene also take the stand and tell the jury what they believe they see that's taking place in the video?
I believe so, Your Honor, because, again, with the way video surveillance is increasing, at this point, a video can't always speak for itself. So in those situations, it wouldn't be reasonable to have the jury be deprived of relevant evidence. So it would be possible to have, again, someone who has watched the video, has gained their own perceptions based off that video to opine as to what is being shown on that screen.
So the state could put forth 12 other witnesses to do the same thing?
Well, no, Your Honor. And this, it would have to be someone, again, who is familiar with the area, like with Detective Campanella in this case. He was able to see the crime scene. He was able to watch the video. And
I'm sure he wasn't the only officer that was on the scene processing that crime scene after that shooting. So there could be a dozen people who also had that same experience of going to the crime scene after the shooting occurred. So trying to understand where the line is with regard to 701. The testimony has to be rationally based on the witness's perception. So what are we talking about when we're discussing perception here? In Singh, there was an officer who was on the scene and testified at trial, but had seen the sneakers on the defendant's feet that night. In Sanchez, we had the parole officer who also testified with regard to the picture in the Be on the Lookout flyer, but this was somebody who had personally met with a defendant many, many times over the course of the past year. Here we have an officer who was not there at the scene of the crime, who watches a video and visits a crime scene.
Yes. There,
that's not similar to the facts in Singh and Sanchez. It's more similar to Lazo looking and comparing and telling the jury what he thinks.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, the detective didn't have to witness the crime, or again, like Sanchez says, didn't have to witness the crime. Singh says that he doesn't have to be superior to the jury in evaluating an item. So Detective Campanella's testimony does fit squarely within this court's recent holdings. He, again, was able to review the video and, based on his own perception, testify as to his personal observations.
Ms. Woody.
I hear you trying to limit it so that it's not only someone who watched the video, it's someone who watches the video and also visits the crime scene. But I'm not sure why that would be relevant, because the parts that it seems like defendant is objecting to didn't have anything to do with Detective Campanella having visited the crime scene. So, for example, they're objecting to him having said, as the Chief Justice mentioned, that he fired the gun and that he turned around. None of that has to do with visiting the crime scene, because when he visited the crime scene, he wasn't able to watch the defendant fire the gun or turn around. So why, I'm just not understanding, where are you getting that as long as the person watches the video and visits the crime scene, even if their testimony has nothing to do with the fact that they visited the crime scene, then that's enough?
Your Honor, I guess I misstated. Again, just focusing on Sanchez, since Detective Campanella did watch the video, he reviewed it himself, it was based on his own perceptions. It didn't require him he didn't need to do more. He didn't require him to personally see the crime scene himself or be there.
So then, as Justice Pierre-Louis asked, then you're saying the defendant could hire a whole number of witnesses to come in and say, I watched the video and the defendant did not turn around. I watched the video and the defendant did not fire the gun.
Yeah, if it's based on their own personal perceptions of the video.
So then it just becomes testimony of warring, you know, this is what I think the video shows, this is what I think the video shows.
Essentially, in regards to the video narration, in regards to the video narration in this case, again, defense could do the same, the state could do the same, provide video narration testimony. The jury needs an explanation in certain areas as to what is happening in the video. It could be grainy, it could be super complex. So the state urges that, you know, Detective Campanella, even with the comments that he made, if this court found that it was an error, it would fall under the harmless error analysis. It didn't have the capacity to create an unjust result. Again, the state had the testimony of Investigator Toff, who explained who provided testimony and explained that the gun could not be discharged or fired on its own. And then there was still the testimony of Officer McGee. So taking away Detective Campanella's testimony, it didn't cause the jury to reach a verdict that it otherwise would not have.
So you've testified that Detective Campanella's use of the word firing was ambiguous, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't the detective himself distinguish between firing and accidentally discharging?
In regards to...
During his testimony on cross-examination that we were talking about earlier, doesn't he distinguish between the two, suggesting that, as he's framed it, firing means one thing, accidental discharge means another?
But that was, again, it was in response to defense counsel's question.
Why does that matter? The question is, was his use of the term firing ambiguous?
In regards to the cross-examination, it wasn't at that point. But
so it's ambiguous on direct, but later on cross-examination, when he says he's running while he's firing, and then he's asked, could have been an accidental discharge. Oh, no. Not with Smith and Wesson. That's not ambiguous.
Well, Your Honor, for the direct examination, again, he didn't express an opinion. It wasn't until defense counsel asked him to express an opinion on cross-examination.
Right, and the opinion that he expresses on cross-examination, set aside its propriety for a moment, don't we look at his testimony altogether? And looking at how he has parsed the difference between firing and accidental discharge, is there any ambiguity in what he said on direct?
No, Your Honor. In looking at his testimony as a whole, it wasn't ambiguous if in that respect. However, the question was based off of what defense counsel asked in regards to whether it was done accidentally or intentionally.
One last question. Did the video speak for itself here?
Your Honor, it did not. It was a dark video, and the flashes that were seen in the video, the jury needed an explanation as to what was that flash, what came out of that flash, just like Detective Campanella explained to them, like, this is, based on this flash, I know that there's going to be a shell casing in this general direction. So I don't think the video spoke for itself in this particular case.
But you already had another witness that was there who experienced it through his own personal perception that explained to the jury what happened in Officer McGee.
Yes, but their testimony was different. Officer McGee's testimony, again, was in relation to what he experienced and what happened, as were Detective Campanella's, was based on his observations and the part of his investigation.
Didn't Detective Campanella, sorry, also testify that he never actually found the shell casing that he expected to find? So he needed to testify that defendant had turned around and fired the weapon because that would explain why he found a shell casing there, but he never actually found the shell casing there.
Yes, he never found the shell casing there. But again, however, he was, as he was testifying, he was explaining to the jury, again, his process of sussing out the crime scene.
Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Woodard?
Your Honor, just that the defendant's conviction should be affirmed as Detective Campanella's testimony was admissible.
Thank you. Mr. Murawski.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I just want to correct a few things that might have been confused, but the detective did find the shell casing from the defendant's gun at the scene. What he was not able to find was the actual bullet. The bullet is lost, but he did find the shell casing at the scene. So just to clarify that part of the record. Also, the defendant and Mr. Shalom tend to give a more dramatic presentation to what the officer actually, the detective actually testified to. The detective didn't testify that he turned directly at the officer. He said nothing about aiming at the officer. He just said that the defendant turned towards the officer. Okay, he said that. Oh, the suspect, I'm sorry. He said the suspect turned towards the officer. And he says, here's where the suspect has turned and discharged the round. Now, we see the defendant is, in his testimony, has testified to running from the officer and then turning and seeing the officer in his peripheral. That could only mean that he turned towards the officer. If you're running away from an officer and then you turn and see his peripheral, that only means you're turning towards him. The clear interpretation of his testimony is that as in, when he was running from the officer, he turned towards the officer.
Why is that so?
I'm sorry.
Why is that so? Couldn't you look over the other shoulder? The peripheral could be from either side.
Well, that doesn't matter. Did he turn toward him the other way? Either way, he turned toward him.
No, but when you're talking about with your eyes seeing something peripherally, it's suggesting that you're not aligned with the person, that you're not facing them. It's only out of the corner of an eye that you have a partial view. That doesn't,
right.
It sounds inconsistent with being aligned with someone.
But the testimony was that he was fleeing from the officer. He was taking direct flight away from the officer. And then at one point, he said he turned and then saw the officer's peripheral. So
These sound like arguments to the jury.
You
make the argument to the jury based on what the video showed. Why do you have to have the witness come in and tell the jury what the video shows?
Well, there was no, first of all, what's important here is the need for proper objections. The defendant says, well, we made an objection, that should be good enough for everybody. But that's not true. As Justice Sussman
said. Let's hold off about the objection for just a moment. Why is it appropriate for the officer who didn't see any of this to provide that testimony?
Well, it's ideally speaking, he probably didn't need to provide that. And what's important to the Attorney General in this case is that we look at the detective's full testimony and rule on the different aspects of the testimony in terms of future cases. The Attorney General asked this court to find that the detective can testify to the location of shell casings, his expected finding of evidence. The forensic detective who shows up at the scene and starts gathering evidence, that is appropriate.
And even the defendant doesn't dispute that, as you heard earlier.
Right. The defendant, for the first time, doesn't dispute that. But in their briefing, it seems like they're disputing their entire testimony.
So let's focus on the critical aspect that the questioning has looked at. What's your position as representative of the Attorney General on that testimony?
Well, we conceded in our brief that it shouldn't have been said. And we're confident that with proper guidance and proper structure and a proper method to develop these issues ahead of time would avoid these things in the future. Like Mr. Shalom said, you can't keep objecting in front of the jury. Well, that's why you have a pretrial hearing. You have a pretrial hearing and you hammer these things out ahead of time so that you're not constantly interrupting the trial and doing it in front of the jury. So I think that the appellate division's opinion in Watson directly addresses that concern. You need pointed objections here. I mean, there's a lot of statements. There's like dozens of pages of officer testimony here regarding the narration. It's important that you have proper objections. You can't just make a blanket objection and expect that it covers everything. That's not fair to the trial judge, and it's not fair to the state. There needs to be a pointed objection. Like at one point it was said, isn't this already testified to? Okay, well, the defendant could say it's cumulative. This part of the testimony is cumulative. Once he starts talking about the defendant's conduct, we already have it from the eyewitness. We don't need it from him. Okay, that could have been an objection the trial judge could have dealt with. Maybe he would have stricken that testimony. Maybe the prosecutor wouldn't have gone there. Maybe the prosecutor said, all right, I don't need this. I just need the testimony about the evidence collection. But that's why it's frustrating when proper objections are not lodged. And to make a meritless objection at the outset of the testimony is unhelpful. Because the initial objection was, well, he didn't see any of this. Well, what is that? He didn't even know what he was going to testify to. He didn't get to that business about turning until halfway through his testimony. Most of his testimony was about, this is what I looked at. This is what I was looking to expect evidence. This is what I found evidence. And compared it to the engineer's diagram. That was the whole purpose of his testimony. He was not called there to give an opinion as to the defendant's state of mind. He was not called there. The prosecutor did not emphasize his testimony in summation on that. It was not used in that fashion at all. It was used for his finding of the evidence. So you say
it was a meritless objection, but you're conceding that the testimony that we're discussing today should not have been given. I gather defense counsel knew where this was going when you put a witness on the stand that was not there and doesn't have personal.
Well, if he knew exactly where it was going, then he should have focused it and said he should not make any statements as to the defendant's state of mind. Instead, he was making a blanket objection to anything the detective said. That is not helpful. That is not appropriate. You need to make pointed objections. Now,
I hear you acknowledging that the specific comment about the defendant having turned around and having fired the weapon should not have been made. But then I also saw in your brief that it seemed like you were arguing that a detective can closely scrutinize a surveillance video in a way that is far superior to the opportunities afforded to the jury with slowing down, pausing, and zooming in as much as they needed. So are you arguing that, in general, an officer who was not there but has simply watched the video with what you call the ability to slow down, pause, and zoom, should be able to narrate what they see in the video that has nothing to do with how they process the crime scene, and it is instead only about what they believe they're viewing in the video? Or are you acknowledging, as it seems like you did in this case, that that type of testimony should not have been allowed, and that there does have to be some sort of real life personal perception outside of the video?
Well, as far as what we quoted as saying that the observer of the video can do in preparation for a case, it's not necessarily what the Attorney General is saying. It's also what the appellate division said in Watson, that there's a big difference between someone who's viewing a video in preparation for a case and just showing it to the jury in real time. There is a distinction that has to be acknowledged. I mean, to the extent we acknowledge it, and perhaps we need certain requirements before we let that happen, we acknowledge that. But it shouldn't just be, oh, if the jury can see it, there's no need for narration. That's overly simplistic. That rule does not exist anywhere in the country, really. And it's something that this pretrial hearing will accomplish. And we ask the court for, you know, guidance as to conducting these pretrial hearings to avoid these slip-ups. Because even the appellate division said in its ruling that the detective inadvertently spoke to the defendant's state of mind. The appellate division wasn't suggesting that this was choreographed and it was the purpose of his testimony. It was an isolated remark. It was kind of random. It wasn't the purpose of his testimony. It wasn't emphasized. And that's very important when you're determining harmless errors. How is it used by the prosecutor? Now,
in addition to a 104 hearing, would training and a statement from your office to the county offices be helpful here? Because even in this argument, we have your concession about the propriety of the testimony, and we have a different take on the part of the state.
Well, one of the things that has to be pointed out is that this trial, as well as all the trials pointed out to by Mr. Shalom in his brief, they all took place prior to Singh and Sanchez. The Attorney General is optimistic that these court's opinions in Singh and Sanchez will have a positive effect. They're well received by the counties. They're eager for this type of clarity, and that This will happen less and less with this court's guidance, but we do think that there is training taking place based on just Singh and Sanchez alone, and that they should avoid statements like saying the defendant when you should be saying the suspect. Now, that was harmless here because everybody agreed he was there, but that's one thing that we train on. Don't say, you know, this is a defendant discharging a gun. You could say something, this is where the gun discharged. You could say that because it's a neutral observation based on the blip on the screen showing where the gun discharged. A neutral observation, as this court said in Singh, an objective neutral observation is what should be restricted to by the witness during narration. They should not be giving any opinions as to the defendant's state of mind. They should not be interpreting what the defendant intended to do. They should only strictly limit their observations to what is taking place on the screen, like a play-by-play announcer as described by the court in Watson. Now, we acknowledge the errors here, but they were fleeting errors. They did not overcome the powerful testimony. I mean, the defendant's defense was really strained. I mean, the expert testimony testified, you need to pull that trigger hard in order for that gun to discharge. It doesn't discharge by accident. And defendant, even though we could quibble over the exact things defendant said, defendant admitted the gun was in his hand when it went off. I think that's clear. And you had the eyewitness testimony of Officer McGee, who said he turned and he pointed it at me. And it was a mischaracterization of the officer being a lay witness. This officer's an eyewitness. This officer's an eyewitness, and he's not given his opinion. He's given his testimony as to what he saw. So you have the powerful testimony of the witness, the expert, and the defendant's own concessions, and which we think that certainly, and the jury was instructed here. We recognize there might be a need for more exact instructions, and we agree with the appellate division that maybe this could be referred for a proper instruction. But there were good instructions given here. There were still instructions as to it was the jury's responsibility to find the facts. It was the jury's responsibility to accept testimony or not accept testimony. They were to judge credibility. No extra request was made for an additional instruction. Now, there's a burden on the state here to present these things properly, but we think there's a equal burden on the defendant to properly set the meets and bounds of the discussion, because as envisioned by the Watson opinion, is that if you have this pretrial procedure, maybe the state and the defense will get together and say, all right, this is what I plan to do with this video. Apparently from this case, if it was done properly, the defendant might have said, okay, I'm not going to object to anything about the finding of the shell casings and the looking for evidence, but don't go into the defendant's state of mind in describing the defendant's conduct. That very well could have taken place here had we had a pretrial thing and it was done properly. But, you know, we can't go after the fact. The state can't be ambushed after the fact for the first time. Like these statements, yeah, three of these statements were put in the petition for certification and they were put in the APTIV, and then a fourth one appeared in a supplemental brief. That's fine. But, you know, this wasn't objected to where it should have been objected to, and it's very important. And we asked the court that in this process, a global objection is really not helpful. And when you look at the Watson opinion, it's very interesting. From the Watson opinion, a similar global objection was made at the outset of that testimony, and it was rejected by the judge. But nevertheless, the defense attorney still made some objections after that. And he said, and they were different from the original global objection. And the judge sustained some of those. He overruled others. But we understand that it might be clumsy to do all that in front of the jury. We recognize that. But it should be done somewhere. And a pretrial hearing is a good place for it. But it should not be done for the first time on appeal. The state should not have to be addressing specific objections that could have been raised when the state could have done something about it. If these objections were made at trial, the state could have easily avoided the question. They could have rephrased the question. It could have easily been avoided if it's been brought up in a timely fashion. It's, you know, ambushing the state and having to do a retrial should not be the standard practice. Now, we don't think it should be the standard practice to just dump this in front of the jury and expect everybody to sort it out in front of the jury. That's not ideal either. But, you know, one thing that we've learned from Singh and Sanchez is that guidance is coming, and it will have a positive effect. Perhaps we need more. We need, because video evidence is being increasingly used, and it is increasingly important. And we don't want to have a regimen where nobody could comment on that video testimony, because there may be circumstances where it is helpful to the jury. And we don't want to just say, under all circumstances, unless the detective was there and saw the incident. But he was there. He was there, and he investigated the crime scene. And it was brought out, can this side bring in 12 witnesses and the other side bring in 12 witnesses? The trial judge has other tools at his disposal to stop something from getting out of hand. I mean, if the state brings a witness or two to say one thing, and the defendant brings a statement or two to say the same, to say the opposite, the judge could say, all right, your point's made, no more witnesses. I think this came up in Singh and Sanchez as well. The judge has tools at his disposal to rein in, you know, dragging people in off the street and having them recite the video.
The questions went to admissibility. We all understand that cumulative testimony can be stopped. But the threshold question is whether even that first witness should be permitted to say certain things. And we appreciate your thoughtful concession on that.
Well, for example, someone narrating the video shouldn't be able to say the defendant firing the gun when the question is whether it was accidental or purposeful. We acknowledge that. But the video is clear that he's turning. That's just an observational thing. And if the video's not 100% clear, or the video's fast moving, or it's happening at a different...
Is the video clear that he's turning toward the officer?
The video shows that it's not the clearest video, but it shows...
On that aspect of it, I wouldn't say it's...
What's that? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Turning toward the officer is what's being talked about
here. Well, if you're running away from an officer and you're turning to the point where you can see him and he's your peripheral, I think that's a logical... It doesn't take... When you're running directly away from somebody, it doesn't take much to turn toward them. Any turn is going to be toward them. And there was a statement about him getting shot in the back of the leg, but you could turn like this and then continue on flight, and the officer didn't return fire until after he was fired at. So that would explain why there was the turn to fire and the continued flight and the shot in the calf. That's not inconsistent with what transpired. So
let me ask you about what I probed before, the justification for putting the officer on the stand to explain his or her investigation. We know from State versus McLean that this court has imposed limitations on lay opinion in circumstances where the officer would want to explain what he or she did, yet we found that was over the line because it's unduly influential. So with regard to the judge allowing the witness in the first place to take the stand to explain the investigation, is that always a permissible justification to have a separate witness describe the video? Because they're up there, judge, to explain the word is processing, whatever that means, the scene. Is that, you know, to be presumptively or always a justification that gets that witness before the jury?
That would be analyzed on a case-by-case basis based on the...
When would it not be allowed?
If the defendant...
Say, I want to come on and testify to explain to the jury what I did in investigating this.
Well, if it would probably be allowed, since the state has its burden to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. Just because the defendant's taken a certain position in his opening statement doesn't mean the state is alleviated of its burden. The state still has its burden to show the physical evidence, and if the physical evidence corroborates the testimony, the state's always allowed to do that, unless the defendant wants to concede. But even when the defendant concedes, the state's still allowed to do this, to show the strength of their evidence, to show that the physical evidence matches up with the testimony. That's important. That's something that should be allowed, and that's something we asked this court to find in this case, that part of the testimony was proper. Even if the officer strayed beyond that and erred, we asked this court to make a finding that the original purpose of the testimony was proper. In fact, the defendant even objects to that. I mean, even concedes that today. So, and in the future, when it's explained to the parties and they say, this is what I want to use it for, they might say, okay, if you're just using it for the bullets, fine. Then they could tell the court, we've agreed that we're just going to do this to show where the bullets were found. And the judge could say, all right, but don't stray from that. And then you could avoid these digressions, these unfortunate digressions that we acknowledge that should not have been made. But certainly the judge is in the best position to make these determinations as to whether it should be allowed in the first instance.
I think we have your position on that on the 104 point. Is there anything else you'd like to present?
Other than that, this was not reversible error. These statements were not why this officer was called. An overwhelming majority of his narration was property. We asked the court to find that. And that these few stray instances, which were unfortunate but fleeting and in the context, not overly damning. And we asked that we affirm the conviction and consider applying the Watson framework for future incidents.
Thank you, Mr. Murawski. Ms. McLean, did you want to offer rebuttal?
My prior.
And we will take the matter under advisement. Thank you, counsel, for the helpful.